glucose effects on night shift, EMS pay problems, tricks to EMS self-evaluation, and we're going to talk about EMS management of asthma and its effects in this week's tip of the week. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's program. We've got a great show coming up for you. Included in this week's episode is a great story that attempts to tell us and help us all evaluate our EMS services and the quality of care that each of them provide. That's in the news this week. Then, after the news, we'll be looking at EMS management of asthma in the field for our tip of the week. And all of that's coming up next here on this week's episode of the MedicCast. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure you check out the additional links and information you can find for yourself over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find that at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link right there at the top of the page. Just click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episodes. And when you're there, you can scroll down, find whatever episode you might be looking for. There's also a search box on the site in the upper right-hand corner. So if you need to search for something, you can put in some keywords there, find something that I may have covered in a past episode. Take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show and understand how it applies to your EMS practice and follow your own protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, make sure you do so. I love to hear from you. You can email me here at podmedic@mac.com. Just shoot me an email with your comments, your questions, whatever you might need to think of, or suggestions for future episodes, interview ideas. There's lots of things that I can always use from the MedicCast community. It helps keep the show going here. Either way, I work to respond back to every email that comes in, and I will get back to you, so keep them coming. Also, don't forget, if you're an iPhone or Android user, check out the new free MedicCast app in your device's store. Just search for MedicCast EMS app. Also, the MedicCast survey is up again. I sent out an email blast a few weeks ago about it, but if you don't get the email newsletter, and you can get that over at the website, please go ahead and take a moment and head over to mediccast.com/survey. Take the MedicCast survey there. It helps me to continue to tell advertisers a little bit about the general aspects of our audience here and keeps the show coming out to you for free. So I thank you for doing that. That's enough contact information. We'll go ahead and get on into this week's news coming up next, but please remember to support our sponsors. They're a member of our family here. We pick them very carefully. Let them know you heard about them here on the MedicCast. Follow up on the information. Check out their websites. Try out their software in the case of something like emsmanager.net. All of those things tell them that you appreciate their support for the MedicCast, and tell them thanks for supporting the show. Kicking off this week's EMS news is a new study on the impact of night shift work on the body and how it might be affecting you. Apparently, working even a single night shift can increase your blood glucose levels and stimulate additional insulin release. Both of these can be precursors for type 2 diabetes. The study, released soon in the journal Sleep, had participants work a day and a night shift under controlled laboratory conditions, including meal monitoring and regular blood sugar checks. What they found was that night shift workers experience impaired glucose tolerance related to their shifts. Now, the fear is here, of course, that workers who work a lot of night shifts over the course of their lifetime could be increasing the likelihood that they'll develop type 2 diabetes. Now, admittedly, the sample size in this study is pretty small. More research is needed, not just to confirm the findings, but also to look into ways to counteract the effects of this over the long term. I mean, somebody has to work night shift, right? Dietary adjustment might be one way, hypoglycemic medications may be another, but in the meantime, if you work a lot of nights, you might want to look at other controllable risk factors for diabetes and try to limit them, since you'll be adding another one every time you go to work. Now, this includes things like limiting your carbohydrate intake, increasing your vegetable and fiber intake, getting some additional exercise, and losing a little bit of weight, which we all can stand to do. All of this will be necessary anyway. I mean, let's be realistic. These are things we should already be doing as we strive to be healthier. So this is just another reminder of why we work to stay healthy for ourselves and our families. Don't let the night shift bring you down. Next up in the news, we'll take a look at the vast pay disparities of EMS professionals across the United States. At a time when we're focusing on different things than acts of bravery EMS professionals and other first responders do when we rush towards developing dangerous situations and take care of other people rather than ourselves, it's time for us to look at how we are all compensated for this. In this article from the Salt Lake Tribune website at Salt Lake City, Utah, they looked at vast disparities in pay for various EMS providers across the country. They also looked at recent cutbacks for large EMS agencies and cities, as well as budget cutbacks that are taking effect everywhere. Now, I applaud the Salt Lake Tribune for putting out this article. It's a good, hard look at how little we are compensated for the work we do. They cite a report from GEMS magazine last year, and in it they found that 28% of large municipalities and EMS agencies had hiring freezes in place. They weren't filling vacancies, and they weren't going to be having any cost of living raises for the fourth straight year in a row. All of this at a time when many of us, EMTs and paramedics, are making less than city garbage collectors. I urge you to take a look at this article. It's a good look at emergency medical services, and it includes data from several surveys and different government agencies on the numbers of EMS professionals and where and how EMS professionals work in this country. See where you fit into the picture and see what this picture paints for what we do in the world out there. I'd love to hear from you about it. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from you. What do you think about this article about what we make as EMS professionals? Finally, we go from an article on why EMS systems are the same to articles on how EMS systems are all very different. In this article from EMSWorld.com, author Robert Sullivan attempts to define how good EMS systems should be evaluated when comparing each other, comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, so to speak. He states, and I agree, if you've seen one EMS system, well, then you've only seen one EMS system. Every system is so very different. In some systems, providers are all volunteers, BLS and ALS. In others, ambulances are staffed by BLF providers, with ALS providers following only in chase vehicles. When someone calls 911, they expect they're going to get a high-quality EMS system to respond, but how do you define a high-quality EMS system? Now, I disagree with some of Robert's assumptions. I especially disagree with his approach to measure EMS primarily from the standpoint of time, our time to transport, our time to arrival on scene. We're not a system of race car drivers. We are a system of healthcare professionals. And I have to say, the only benchmark we should be using is the outcomes for our patients. Now, if one agency gets to the patient in 4 minutes, and agency B gets to the patient in 8 minutes, but agency A only has 50% of their patients survive, well, then time has nothing to do with how we handle our patients, does it? Now, in fairness to Robert, he does bring clinical performance into the picture later on in the article, but it's after he talks extensively about time. We all know that time is rarely essential to our patient treatment. In fact, we've all seen when we take a patient we think is critical to the hospital, only to find out that they sit there and wait in the hospital bed for treatment and to see the doctor and everything else when we come back with another patient later on. Now, while some of us might think this is negligence on the part of the hospitals, remember that their benchmarks are very carefully tracked around patient outcomes, and if this was hurting a patient, it would be something that they would quickly stomp on. Now, I could go on and on about this article. I actually think most of the article is great, and it's great for us to establish benchmarks, but I do have to disagree that those benchmarks should be anything about the clock. What do you think? Let me know what you think after you check out the article yourself. I'd love to hear what you think of Robert's approach to evaluating high-quality EMS systems. Summertime is a time of allergens, and as we've been discussing that on the show in recent weeks, it seems kind of a natural transition to head into a look at asthma, a condition also triggered by allergens. Now, you may be encountering more and more patients with respiratory issues this time of year as the air quality gets worse, and we may be handling some of those asthma or COPD patients. We talked about albuterol last week on the show, so this week we're going to check out the primary condition we use it for. Let's get into this week's tip segment for EMTs and paramedics on asthma. So this week's tip of the week here at the Medicast is going to be talking about asthma, care of our asthma patients. And if you've ever had an asthma patient, or perhaps you have a family history of asthma, you might have some understanding of what this disease is and its overall encompassing category of reactive airway disease. But maybe the rest of us need a little bit of a review, or if you're a student, perhaps this is something you can use to as a resource for your classes. First of all, we're going to talk about what is asthma and a little bit about the difference between asthma and reactive airway disease, because you may hear both terms. Morbidity and mortality stats. I think this is something that's important for us to look at with a lot of our different disorders and diseases. Get a sense of how prevalent problems are, what they mean to the overall system. I think we have a better understanding of the outcomes associated with our diseases that we treat in the field. We'll have a better understanding of what we can do to get ahead of those diseases and maybe get a better understanding of treating those diseases. We'll also talk about signs and symptoms. We always have to talk about how we can recognize certain problems, and also the treatments and common medications, and not just the things we might use in the EMS sector, but we'll also get an idea of what patients might have prescribed for them, and also what you might expect these patients to get as treatments at the hospital, something to keep in mind. So what is asthma? Well, according to the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, asthma is a chronic lung disorder that causes inflammation and constriction in the small airways. It's caused by a triggering allergen or event. So what does that mean? Well, asthma is a very prevalent problem in the United States, and it affects about 16 million adults and about 7 million children here in the U.S. at any given time. Currently, those stats are about 2009 stats, I think, from the CDC. They cause about 13.3 million doctor and hospital visits each year. And if the patient is admitted to the hospital, so let's say they go to the hospital and they aren't just treated and released in the ER, if they get admitted, they spend 3.2 days on average in the hospital. Why? Well, because this patient has had such a severe attack that they have had to been intubated and they have been put on a vent and they needed major treatment and monitoring to make sure that they were stable again. And of course, they have to wean them off the vent and extubate them and then monitor for the side effects of being on a ventilator. It just ends up being a longer process. So anything that patients can do and we can do to better manage early stages of an asthma attack and be better prepared to aggressively treat our patients, we can help alleviate perhaps an extended hospital stay. Deaths per year. This is a difficult thing. Certainly there are things that are more likely to kill you in any given year. But for asthma patients, this is severe because people do die from asthma. I think often people who have not been familiar with asthma or new to the EMS game, you may think of asthma as something, you know, that kid in school had and he puffed on his inhaler and he was fine. Well, asthma causes 3,600 deaths a year in the United States. Certainly a significant number, and if you start thinking about spreading those numbers around the various areas of the United States, it's highly likely that each year someone in your region, maybe not in your immediate service area, but somewhere in your region, several people have died from asthma attacks and as the primary diagnosis, and they died as a result of that attack. So not insignificant, and it's likely that you could face a patient that has a severe enough attack that they might die from it. So you need to be prepared and understand that. Signs and symptoms associated with asthma. People will start complaining of a persistent cough. This is that they're starting to feel that constricted airways. They're starting to trap air, and that tickle causes them to want to cough and try to force those airways open by increasing the back pressure behind the constricted area. Chest tightness and shortness of breath, of course, are common symptoms. Auscultation of the lungs will reveal wheezes in many cases. It may be in different parts of the lungs. You want to definitely identify what areas of the lungs are affected, and you know where the small airways are. Again, this is the bronchioles that branch off from the bronchi. And so it's not likely to be way in the bases, but you'll probably hear wheezing in different lung fields. It's important to understand that the absence of wheezing is not good. In a patient with an asthma attack, if they're not wheezing and they're still short of breath, the reason is because they are no longer moving air. The wheeze is a sign that air is going back and forth through that passage. If there's no wheeze, there's no air movement. So in a person with an ongoing attack and still showing signs and symptoms of shortness of breath and hypoxia, this is an ominous sign. And again, be prepared for very aggressively treating this patient. Some of the common things that we think about as triggers for asthma. Asthma has a precipitating event or trigger. It could be an allergen like cat dander or there are all kinds of things, cigarette smoke. But there is some kind of precipitating trigger or event. So stressful events can cause problems. Allergens and respiratory irritants are the most common causes of problems, including pet dander and smoke and odors. So a patient who had somebody come over and make an unusual meal with a new spice, some kind of spice, that odor, that strong spice and herb odor might cause them to become have an asthma attack. And so you need to identify what the possible causes and triggers might be. Many asthma patients understand what some of their triggers are, and so you might be able to get some information from the patient or a family member. Again, these patients, if they have an asthma attack, are probably speaking in one-word sentences, so you're going to have to make your questions count. But it's understanding what might have triggered it is important. They may also be reacting to a recent respiratory infection or even another infection somewhere in the body. Again, this reduces their immune system, and it could makes them more likely to have an overblown immune response because the immune system's already kind of trying to get into action or has been in action as a result of the recent infection. So ask questions about, have they been sick recently? Stress or anxiety. Again, this is that precipitating event thing. If someone is having a high stress in situation, stress reduces your immune response and so makes it less effective. And this is an overblown or overreacted immune response. So certainly somebody with a less effective immune system is going to be more likely to suffer an attack. So anything that causes that kind of stress, it might be anxiety, a fight with your boss or your spouse, you can find these triggers. Gastroesophageal reflux disease is a pertinent history item. This is probably because that stomach acid that is constantly being brought up into the back of the oropharynx, probably some of it may get down into the air passages and cause progressive irritation over time. This is not a full-blown aspiration, but it wouldn't take much increase in the acidity to damage fragile lung tissue and cause irritation there. Weather changes, another precipitating event. You know, changes in high pressure to low pressure, or low pressure to high pressure can, again, be a precipitating and triggering event for an asthma patient. So what treatment are we thinking about here for these patients? Well, first off, I want to impress upon you one important thing. The most important thing you can do to be prepared to treat your patient is to be able to recognize the onset of an asthma attack and understand the severity level for this patient. How do you do that? Well, you need to ask one simple question, either of the patient themselves or of a bystander that's a family member or knows this patient. And that question is basically, have you had an asthma attack this severe before? And if you had an asthma attack this severe, have you ever been intubated? Okay? Why? Because if a patient has had a severe enough asthma attack and they've been intubated before, you need to be thinking that you need to be ready to intubate this patient. Now, you're not just going to drop a tube right there, but you need to be prepared to intubate a patient appropriately, if they're not moving air effectively themselves, that you may have to try to manage that airway for them and try to get some air in there some way, somehow. It's not always going to work, but that may be the resource and the solution for you. So you need to recognize that, and the only way to recognize it is to ask good history questions, and that's the key question for an asthma or any kind of chronic respiratory illness. You need to remove the patient from the presence of the trigger if you can do that. So if you can identify the trigger, the patient may know what causes it. I love the story I heard a long time ago. A guy would say, we're visiting grandma, and every time we come to visit grandma, Junior has an asthma attack. And sometimes it's really severe, and sometimes we have to take Junior to the emergency room for treatment. Well, I started looking at this, and I started asking some questions. No, mom and dad don't smoke. No, they know the kid has asthma, and it's pretty severe, so they don't have any pets at home. They keep the house really clean. Everything's good. And grandma smokes like a chimney and has 12 cats. Well, duh. this is what's caused the asthma attack, and we need to remove the patient from the home, get them out to the ambulance, and try to get those ongoing triggers away from the patient. That's an overblown example, but you can start thinking about that. You may not be able to remove them from the trigger, but if you can, it will help. Acute therapy initially is going to be the patient's own rescue inhalers, but if they've called 911, it is likely that those rescue inhalers are not working effectively, and they have been instructed by their physician to try their normal dose of rescue inhaler and try their normal nebulizer treatment at home using albuterol in many cases or some kind of combination treatment. If that doesn't work, they're going to call you. And if you show up on the scene, if you're an ALS provider or BLS provider, BLS providers can help administer the patient's own nebulizer. In some cases, in some areas, the BLS units actually have their own albuterol inhalers, so that's a good thing. You may also, at the BLS level, need to be prepared to administer an EpiPen, okay? ALS providers are going to be ready to intubate and aggressively manage that airway and use all the medications we have. BLS providers, guess what? We're going to give them Epi. So if it's that severe that albuterol and Atrovent are not working, maybe we don't have the ability to give steroids in the field, we are going to have to move right on into giving epinephrine, or maybe moving on to another more specific beta agonist. And so we can talk a little bit about that. The acute therapy is rescue inhalers, bronchodilators, and corticosteroids. Okay, so those are the key treatments for this, and often steroid treatment is what tips the balance for these patients. A lot of jurisdictions, including mine, do not have the ability to give steroids to patients in severe allergic reactions or asthma attacks, but get them to the ER as fast as you can, because that's where they're going to get the definitive treatment. If the patient's own bronchodilators have not been working, you giving additional albuterol and a Combivent treatment is not necessarily going to make it much better. CPAP may work. Increasing the peak expiratory pressure by putting a CPAP device on may assist with these patients. Again, by increasing that pressure, we can actually help to force the airways open a little bit, so CPAP may be indicated. Long-term therapy really is to find a way to reduce the inflammation and reduce the inflammatory response. So a lot of patients are now on various oral medications that provide long-term inflammatory system management for their bodies. And then they also have a rescue inhaler for acute flare-ups. The long-term therapy includes ongoing courses of corticosteroids, anti-inflammatory medications. In some cases, they have long-acting beta agonists, basically similar to albuterol, but in longer affecting, so they can last all day and work over a long period of time. Or IgE inhibitors. If you remember your immune system, IgE is the antibody responsible for allergic reactions. And so if we can inhibit the response of the IgE antibodies, we can inhibit the body's sense of an asthma attack or any allergic reaction. So those are our treatment programs. Again, be prepared for the worst. Know your treatment protocols, know what you have available for you. Epinephrine may be a treatment of last resort for many of these patients. So know what other beta agonists you have at your command. If you have the ability to administer steroids, that may be important for you as well. Again, CPAP, oxygen clearly are all indicated in this patient. You're going to start off with your basic treatment protocols. You're going to manage airway oxygen, get that oxygen on board right away to improve oxygenation with what little air is moving. If you have an inline capnography device that can measure the expired CO2 for this patient, you can monitor the effectiveness of your treatments using a capnography waveform, and you can actually see the opening of the airways or the closing of the airways by watching the way that that sloped waveform comes across in your asthma patients. And that's a whole other episode, but we can certainly, you can certainly find resources online to talk about that. There are a lot of good resources on this topic, and I have those resources available in the show notes for this episode. I urge you to follow up on them. Again, medicast.com/blog. Find the show notes for this episode and follow up on these resources. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to follow up on all of the information from this week's show over at medicast.com/blog. When you get there, you'll find the show notes link right there at the top of the page, and you can take a moment and check out and follow up on all of that information, the links to the news items you find there, also all of the tips and additional resource links I put there. All of that's there for you as well. You can also sign up for the email newsletter while you're there. There's a little form right there on the right-hand side of the page. Just fill that out, and you can actually get all those links and things sent directly to your email inbox every week. I also welcome your comments and suggestions directly by email, so if you want to, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. You can send in your news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I look forward to hearing from you. And let me know, because I will make sure I get back in touch with you. I work hard to respond to every email that comes in, so please, please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media sites and pages, well, you can do that. You can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So catch me over at Twitter or Facebook, twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, and friend or follow me on those sites. You can also check out the MedicCast on our very own Facebook page. We have over 4,000 followers there. It's growing all the time. Head over and join this growing community at facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join the MedicCast community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning so you can kick off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today and share the show with somebody you know. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, scene safety. BSI.